Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, not one, but two legendary, amazing guests from the band Archers of Loaf. Eric Bachman and Matt Gentling are on the show today, and this is a great interview. More on that in 1 second. I say it's a great interview. It's a great conversation. It's up to you whether or not it's a great interview, but I had a great time having the conversation. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, and the guy who turned me on to Archers of Loaf way back when, and he will get the message to me. He also runs a Instagram page and a Facebook page for Turned Out of Punk. I have a Twitter and an Instagram at Left4Damian if you want to follow me over there. If you want to support the show, the best way to support the show is by telling all your friends about it or subscribing to it and rating it on the platform you're listening to it on, or heading over to turnedoutofpunk.com and picking up a t-shirt. Thank you to everyone who has done that. It is very, very much appreciated over here on the show. I play in a band. We're called Fucked Up. We got some shows coming up in Toronto at the end of October. Going back to the core, I think, is how these shows are kind of being marketed, at least. We're going to be playing some old songs on October, whatever the weekend is, just before Halloween, like we used to do way back when. You can find out more information about that and upcoming releases over at fuckedup.cc. And check out the new video for Oberon, starring my man Camden, my little man Camden. 7 years old now. My God, you blink your eyes and they're all grown up. All right, on to today's show. Today on the show, as I said off the top, legends from the band Archers of Loaf. Matt Gentling and Eric Bachman are here. Both, also Matt plays in Band of Horses, and Eric, of course, plays in Crooked Fingers. And, you know, these are just music legends. And getting a chance to sit down and talk to him about punk rock is why we do this thing. Every time we get a chance to, we're going to do it. That's really, at this point, this thing's back to being a zine. So why not make it fun? This is a cool conversation. They have a new, brand new record coming out on Merge Records in a few short weeks. The album is called Reason in Decline, and you can pre-order it now over at archersofloaf.net or from Merge Records. And they've released a couple songs off this thing, and it is, woo, it's a fantastic record. Also, check out both of those websites, Merge or archersofloaf.net, and find out about upcoming tour dates. They're coming to Toronto. So that's pretty awesome. Just saw that. So that's in January. So get excited, get amped, get set. Here is Eric Bachman and Matt Gentling on Turned Out of Punk. Eric, Matt, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Our pleasure. My pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. Well,
as I was just explaining to you both off air, I've got a number between 1 and 10 for us to pick between before we start the show, but I also spared you from this off air. I'm a huge fan. And so to get to do this with you both, it's going to be we're in for a fun ride, I think.
Oh man. Thanks.
Well, let's start Let's start off by picking that number. I've got a number written down, as I told you, and Merge has sent over, some supervisors to make sure I did not cheat. And we will now pick a number between 1 and 10.
Matthew, please go first. Pick your number.
I'll say 6.
I'll say okay. 2.
2. Okay. The number is 5. Oh, that looks backwards, but it's 5. And I wrote it down on a cannabis extract box, and now we have sealed that. And so
that's fake news, my friend. That's fake news. That's not 5. That's fake.
Well, Matthew, we got to start this off the way they all start off. First of all, how did you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
It's kind of a funny story. Like, I was, you know, like a lot of punks, I was like a, you know, middle-class suburban kid, you know. I didn't have much in the way of real problems. I was well-loved and treated well by my family and stuff, and probably had, I don't know why, I gravitated towards it, but I didn't gravitate towards it immediately. I was turned off mostly by music that was around me when I was a little kid. Most of it was kind of, I thought it was just hokey love songs and things. I've since fallen in love with a lot of that stuff, but you know, it was the '70s and it yacht rock was kind of the thing then. And I guess that turned me off a little. So I wasn't really, I was musically inclined, but didn't really like a lot of the music I heard. And I was riding my BMX bike around with this kid named Kurt, who, he loved heavy metal and he loved punk. And he kept telling me, he's like, Matt, you got to get into the Dead Kennedys. They're amazing and you'll love them. And I thought the name was kind of hokey. I thought it was a little too like self-consciously provocative or whatever. And I don't know, I may be covering my mic here. Sorry if I am.
No, it's fine.
And so he kept pushing it. He kept trying to get me into Metallica as well. And I thought like the lyrics were kind of hokey and the theater was a little bit hokey. I've since got to where I love Metallica, but anyway, we were out riding our BMX bikes around. We went down to, it was either Pastimes or Record Survival. I forget what the place was called at the time. It changed its name a couple of times, but they had a little listening station in there. And he said, Matt, we're not leaving this building until you put these headphones on and you listen to some Dead Kennedys. And he put on Fresh Food for Rotting Vegetables and Kill the Poor came on. And it absolutely blew my mind. I couldn't believe it. It tapped into my sort of young kid spastic nature, you know, like a restless sort of high energy little kid vibe. And then I thought Jello's voice, I loved, like it was so frenetic and terrifying, you know, and the music was just so blistering and awesome that I lost it. And I was like, there's gotta be more like this out there, you know? And so then I started listening to it. And Asheville is kind of a tough place for punk because there was a decent punk community, but you know, they're all a lot older and there was no way to get records around here. It was hard to find any punk records at all. The fact that they had that Dead Kennedys record there was a big surprise. But so you know, you kind of catch things as they could. For instance, the first Sex Pistols record I ever heard was a buddy of mine had scored The Great Rock and Roll Swindle, which is utterly the wrong way to get into the Sex Pistols. Yeah. But it was the only door open at the time. I was aware of their existence, but didn't know anything about them. And that was the first I heard of them. And so, but then there was also a nighttime show, the public radio station here. Sorry if I'm rambling too much.
No. That's what the bread and butter of the show is, just rambling about punk.
Okay. You can edit with a heavy hand.
Oh, God, no. This is, if we edit this, then I got to go back and edit every episode.
How punk would that be to have an editor?
Exactly.
But yeah, so like there was a, I think it was called Sonics. There was a nighttime radio show that a local woman hosted, and it was for like a couple hours starting at midnight on like a Monday night or whatever. And she would just play punk stuff. And a buddy of mine that I rode skateboards around with, he had his family had a tape deck that was programmable like a VCR. Like we thought his dad was like really fancy for that. Like his dad was super into classical music and I guess he would record
for the time that is fancy.
What's that?
For the time that is fancy.
It was, yeah. It was pretty impressive. And so John would tape Sonics so that, you know, because we were kids and in school and our parents made us go to bed and all that stuff, which is, that's a rebellious way to talk about punk. But
a lot of us had to live it. A lot of us had to live that life.
You don't know how I suffered, man. Yeah. But he would tape that show, and the next day, and we built a little half pipe in his backyard and we would skate and listen to all this stuff. And half the time I wouldn't know who it was. Like I heard I Believe by the Buzzcocks, and it would just stick in my head. It's such a beautiful, catchy, wonderful song. But it wasn't until I was working in the archaeology lab in UNC in college that I heard the song come on again. And then they told you who it was. And that's, it wasn't until then that I realized that song was by the Buzzcocks. Mm-hmm. So I was just kind of scraping along. But the upside of that was my window was open, you know, just anything could drift in and I would eat it up. You know, it's how I got into Butthole Surfers and Circle Jerks and stuff. I didn't know what a circle jerk was. And I went home to have dinner with my parents and I was like, God, I'm learning about all these crazy bands with really funny names like Butthole Surfers and Circle Jerks. And my dad just about threw up his food. He was laughing so hard and he had to explain. Luckily, my dad is awesome, has a great sense of humor, and he had to explain it to me. And that was a funny thing from my life.
How did he explain to you? Yeah, that's funny. How did he explain it to you?
I think he said it's when a group of men get together and masturbate together. I think it was that straightforward and simple.
He's a medical doctor. Yeah.
Yeah. My dad was a doctor. My mom was a nurse. So you can only imagine what the dinner table conversations were like. You know, we'd talk about like rectal prolapses and things at the dinner table, practically like it, you know, there was nothing off limits there. That's also where minor surgery would happen. Like, that's where I got most of my stitches removed, is at the dinner table.
My stepfather was not nearly as cool. And when I told him that we wanted to go see a band called the Circle Jerks, he spat out at the dinner table, "You're not going to go see some cum in your face band."
That's good. That's good. Yeah. Wow.
I much He's prefer...
Trying to be a good parent, but yeah, just missing it. Yeah,
I don't know. I think your story's better. Like, I think you've got a line now that you can enjoy for the rest of, and that I can enjoy for the rest of all of our lives.
Oh, absolutely.
However long we last here.
I have to thank my stepfather for my for the trauma that he caused that gave me my entire lyrical career in fucked up.
You know,
I really do owe him.
Yeah, you do. You really do. You really do owe him a thank you for thanks for. Thanks for the abuse or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, Eric, how did you get into punk? What was your entry point?
So I didn't really respond out of the gate because my first exposure to it, I lived in St. Pete, Florida, and I had my parents divorced when I was 8, and I was probably 9. I was still living with my mom, and we lived in St. Pete, and I had a friend named Michael Sheeran, and through him I met a lot of other people. We went to a Catholic school called Holy Family, and there was a guy named Bradley, and he was like, he had had a lung problem, and he had like half of his chest was collapsed, was it concave, and he had one lung problem, but his name was Bradley, and Michael used to always make fun of him by calling him Bradley, like making fun of his name, but he was really into Bruce Lee and really into Kung Fu.
Yeah.
And so we would always I was living with my mom. I had an older brother. My dad was in Chattanooga. And so my mom was working at a Nations Bank, making like $6,000 a freaking year, working as a bank teller, you know? So we were not, you know, rolling in the dough or anything, but we were fine. But, Bradley introduced me to The Clash.
Oh, that's
and
awesome.
So, and he just listened to that music. His dad was into music like that. And his, the music to me, because I was actually at the time, I guess it would have been 1978 or 9, maybe 80, 79, 80, somewhere in that range, because I'm 9, 10 years old. I was born in 70. Anyway, I was into Blondie. And I was into that kind of thing, and Devo, you know, and stuff like that. That wasn't really punk. It was more new wave, you know.
I lump it in. I think both those bands are, you know, like, are certainly fundamental to the foundation of punk. But I think also I like, you know, before it gets codified, like, it's amazing. Like Matt was saying, it's like Buzzcocks all the way to Butthole Surfers.
It was a broad spectrum. That's right. Yeah. That's right. So
I love that. I consider Devo punk as hell.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Certainly in the attitude. Certainly in the subversion.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's a beautiful world. It's so sarcastic and so it's wonderful, you know. And that's the spirit, you know. So, and I was into that kind of thing. And so through that, I got into through Bradley, and he introduced me to all that music. And that stuff was also being played on the radio. Like Blondie and Whippet was being like Devo was being played on the radio, believe it or not. Back then. And so The Clash was my first sort of thing into it. And I think I liked I think I like that kind of rhythmic stuff, but there's some of it that was just like, oh, it's just too aggressive. I don't want that, you know? And so I didn't come into it until later, you know. And I loved that record though. I guess that's the First Class record. And I guess Give Him Enough Rope, Bradley, I remember Bradley having that. We listened to that. And I think London Calling was about to come out. So that'd have been 79, I guess. So it was that around that that time. And that was really the only band that I mean, when I'd hear the Ramones, I'd be like, oh, it's just too, I don't really like that much, you know. Now, of course, now I love it, you know. And it's funny, the metal was a big thing in Florida. And so there was this thing among my peers where if you liked punk and metal, they didn't really, it kind of didn't mix yet. Something, yeah, at least in my community, it kind of was the thing. So with my certain groups of my friends, we, you know, we loved the, Matt, you're talking about the sort of the presentation of metal. Metal is such a fantastical, I'm on a horse. I'm on a horse riding my stallion with my shield and I'm heavy metal. I am going to rock. You know, it's just got this.
Even the real down to earth metal has like a mythical,
I love it. Yeah.
Fantasy element.
I love that aspect of it.
I'm falling for that now. I couldn't understand why all the punk guys went metal and I was bitter about it for the longest time.
Yeah, they're bastards. That's the thing. Yeah.
Now I listen to metal all the time.
Well, I love the fantasy. I love the theater of that. And so then it wasn't until I sort of realized, well, this is sort of silly, but I still love it, you know, that mm-hmm. I kind of fell more into punk. And then when I fell into punk, it was more like Marty Roop. When I was in a band in high school called Iron Beagle. And we played like the punkest we got. We didn't really play punk music. We play a Clash song or two. We would play Led Zeppelin or The Cure or you know stuff that wasn't really. It was more new wave again or just kind of post that. But then Marty Roop got me into 7 Seconds and Minor Threat and Crass and like all the deep hardcore stuff. You know?
Yeah.
And I loved it. At that point, I loved it because they were all skaters and I'm 6'6" and I'm so horrible on my feet. Like I can't. I'm not ill-balanced when I'm just walking, but on a skateboard, I would just sit there and listen to this music, and I would sort of play the tapes, play the cassettes, you know, while everybody else would skate. And so I got to play DJ with a lot of that stuff and learned about a lot of that music that way and never turned back, you know. So
it's amazing how punk is kind of like the antithetical to metal in the way that, like, you know, the bands you mentioned, Kevin's 7 Seconds, Minor Threat, and Crass, like, they're singing all about the opposite of fantasy. Like it's sort of like,
oh, totally. Oh, it's your neighborhood. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Exactly. That's a good point. Hey, can I interject and put something in front of the camera?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome.
It. It's that's backwards. Amazing, that is Iron Beagle and it's still wrapped in the cellophane.
Oh, don't sell it. Yeah. It's going to be worth at least $6.
Oh my gosh.
It'll go up to 7 or 8, man.
Yeah. Hey, maybe. Yeah. You got to time it right. But yeah, time it right.
I
saw Iron Beagle live a couple times.
Yeah, oh, that's awesome.
I miss
you
that.
You guys are a fine band.
I miss that enthusiasm. You know, when you're 14 and 15 and you're in a band and we were just so enthusiastic. I think you're still enthusiastic when you're 20, 23, 25. And at 52, I'm still enthusiastic about certain things, but not in that same way. Not when it's all new. I mean, yeah. I know you play in a band. So, I mean, everybody here, it's just a thing. It's, you know, that enthusiasm, I always, it's just to try to get it back. You know, you never want to lose that, you know.
Yeah. We had a couple like heavy metal high school bands at Asheville High that were both great. And they were like the best dudes ever, like really, really good people. And one of them kind of practiced in my neighbor's like down the hill from where I grew up at my neighbor's house. And one day I was driving somewhere and you could tell they had a gig. They had like a Datsun pickup truck that was just loaded down, like the springs were just flattened out and it with, you know, a whole bunch of amps and gear and stuff, and just a bunch of like dudes with long hair. And it turned out to be those guys. I noticed them and they were on their way, obviously, to play a gig, you know, and we didn't, my high school band didn't have those things. We didn't have gigs, you know, really. And I was so envious that they had a gig, but it was what really grabbed me was just how excited and happy and enthusiastic they were. Like they would stop at stop signs. I guess they're caravanning, like there was another car full of people. And then there was the truck loaded down with gear and they would jump out of the car and run to the truck and talk to each other at stop signs and stuff. They were so excited and they ripped too. They're an excellent band. Yeah. I still keep up with a lot of those guys in those bands, but like, sorry, that was an aside. That's what Eric was talking about is that enthusiasm.
Yeah. And I like that the metal guys, they want to get really good at their instrument. Like, there's a thing about, like, the virtual, like, the Talavas or these guys, they're just phenomenal players. Wow. How are you doing that with your hands, you know? But there's, I kind of appreciate that that sort of discipline behind metal and all that.
And that's a great thing about punk, you know, that I think is different than metal is the fact that you don't need that virtuosity. Like, there's no emphasis on workshopping your instrument, your craft for years. It's like you go out there and you play as soon as you can.
Yeah, and it's a response against that sort of pretension. It's like punk almost comes from like, well, no, I don't have to have that to communicate what I'm feeling or whatever I'm trying to get out, which is beautiful.
For me, wasn't a choice. I've just never had a dexterity to be like, I wish I could play like those guys, but it's just not an option for me. I've been playing bass for a million years and I still am not really a technical player. I think that was another reason I got into punk is just because it was accessible to me.
Yeah.
And punk is not about the chops, you know, you get by on creating a mood and a atmosphere or whatever. So,
well, I would argue that it's not getting by. I would argue that you're required, if you're not going to be dazzling people with your fancy musicianship, you have to have a profoundly interesting personality. That's actually more important to art, to anything.
That's a good point.
To me, so that's why I think it's such a rewarding, and why it's been such a compelling, magnetic form of music, is because people are, if you're not interesting, nobody's gonna watch you or hear you. You know, you have to inherently.
That's an excellent point. And like, that reminds me of how you know, Jello Biafra and his spoken word stuff. He was talking about, he would kind of rail about how conservative metal is. And as a genre, I think that's changed now. I don't think it's like that anymore. But certainly back in the 80s and even into the 90s, metal was a pretty conservative genre stylistically. Mm-hmm. And punk was sort of the more like anything goes sort of approach. And I guess I gravitated toward that as well. But
well, I think Jell's a great example of like what Eric's saying. Like you had to have this charisma to carry these bands in a way. And like, that's why the front person in hardcore is such a key figure, because it is like
a lot of it's like
John Brannan, and like there's so many iconic front people, right?
Yourself included. I mean, that's part of why your band works so well,
because agreed,
sweating and shirtless and just fucking telling the truth. It's like it's interesting. It's like, you know,
I love watching you play live. Like, it's awesome.
Yeah. Well, I am unbelievably flattered. I had no idea that you'd seen us play live. So that is very, very awesome to hear. That is.
It's a treat.
A couple times,
it's a real treat seeing you just rip it up out there, man.
I'm glad no one can see me blush because they don't have the video of this going on. It's the audio. But I think that's it's this genre that once again, like, pushes the idea of just being there, telling your truth, and, you know, I think that's the appeal of it. And that's why I think so many interesting people are drawn to it that wind up doing disparate things creatively in the world. It's just because it's one of the few places where it's like, come here, just do something, get involved.
There's a sense of family to it. Absolutely. There's a sense of family about it. Yeah, I think.
So I guess like Imperial Beagle, you know, you mentioned doing Cure covers. I want to know what the band sounded like. What was the vibe of this band?
It's Iron Beagle.
Imperial Beagle.
I love Imperial Beagle. That's fucking fantastic.
I think that's the name of my friend Danko Jones's podcast about Three's. No, Regal Beagle. Yeah. I think is his Three's Company podcast that he does.
We gotta start a band, man. We gotta start a band called Empirical Beagle.
Beagle. I'm down. Let me know when.
Yeah.
Send me the track.
It's all science rock.
Oh my god. Holy shit. We played The Stranger. I think we played Boys Don't Cry. I know we played In Between Days, some of the more poppy stuff or whatever. But that was all Marty. Marty was bringing all that stuff in. I was bringing in like REM stuff and just Led Zeppelin, you know, classic rock stuff that I liked. Again, I'm from Florida. You know, Florida was very classic rock and metal, and there was the punk thing, and I liked it, but it was really not until I got older, like meeting Marty and starting, that I got into. And I guess my biggest thing was like, I eventually was a really big fan of no wave stuff. I got into like Glenn Branca and Lydia Lunch and Theoretical Girls and The Static and all that stuff. So
I look at that Florida stuff, especially the punk stuff that was coming out of Florida that time. It's so weird. Like, I love it's it, you know, like for everything from the Screaming Sneakers to the Sewer Zombies.
See, I don't know that stuff. I've heard the names. I know the names, but I've not heard. And I know that there's a thing happening there, but I was too young. I was nine, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't even know about the Screaming Sneakers. I love that name.
The Screaming Sneakers, I had a very intense, I smoked DMT in Australia one time and then went backstage to this Foo Fighters concert and ended up smoking weed with Johnny Depp while he's in full makeup from Pirates of the Caribbean. And he asked me if I've ever heard of this band called the Screaming Sneakers. Yeah. And I'd been given a bootleg the day before by my friend in Melbourne of the Screaming Sneakers. Now we're in Brisbane. Uh-huh. And I pull it out and he just starts crying. And he's like, that's my ex-girlfriend's band.
Oh.
Whoa.
It was the most weird experience. But they're an unbelievable power pop band. Well, it was like a Rosebud moment. It was a total like Citizen Kane Rosebud moment.
Totally. Rosebud moment. Totally. Way to make Johnny Depp cry, man.
I love
it. Man. I ruined the makeup.
The actors,
That story has not aged nearly as well, unfortunately.
I think that's my favorite story I've heard in a long time.
It was a weird day. It was a very DMT was and also in my DMT experience, I saw the elves printing out the same pattern that Johnny Depp had on his face.
You were flying. Yeah, you were going nuts.
I was off the DMT. DMT only lasts 15 minutes, and then you're good. But but afterwards, that lasting impression of this pattern I saw the elves making was driven home by Johnny Depp's face paint.
Was he awkward or mad at you about making him cry later, or was it just over?
He was totally good. He gave me his weed, and at the end of the day, and he rolled the rest up in his pant leg, but gave me the joint. And he's like, I'll see you later. And we just talked Florida punk stuff. Like, I think there's a lot of, you know, once again, as much as there's an incredible history of metal in both Asheville and Florida, but there's also just sort of these punk undercurrents that, you know, thrive because not all kids fit in with metal because, like you were saying, Matt, it tends to be more conservative at times and also requires a lot more virtuosity and also it can be a little jockey at times too.
Yeah, totally. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Too macho. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's
exclusionary. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's just totally different, but how did Small come together?
Mike Kenlin, who was trying to start a band. He was a good friend of mine and I played in his band. It was a guy named Matt Walter. The three of us were a band and there was a guy named Kelly Cox, who is he worked at a record store in Louisville for years, but he's a really great dude. And I haven't talked to him in a while, but he started the band with Mike. We had several names before. It was Cupcake UK. We were called Ream, R-E-E-M. We were called a couple other things. I can't quite remember. And then finally, Mike, which I admire this trait in him, he was ambitious enough that he wanted to do his own songs and sing his own songs. So he would come in with guitar riffs and Kelly would sing over them. And Mike's like, this is what I have for it, you know? And so Mike decided to start his own band without Kelly and asked me to come and Matt Walter to come. We had a drummer for a while and that didn't work out. And then they get Chuck Garrison from Superchunk to play. And from Pipe to play. And so it was me and Mike and Matt and Chuck. And we did that probably for a year or two. But then what happened is the same thing that happened to Mike with Kelly happened with me and Mike, where I would present him wrong, or I'd present him web in front. And he was like, no. I don't want those. We're going to do these, you know. I said, well, then fuck you. I'm going to start my own band. And I, And then it ended up being the Archers where EJ and I started getting together. Eric Johnson and I met on the bus and started getting together. And we kind of knew each other from Asheville, but we didn't know each other well. And then he knew Matt and he brought Matt in and then Matt brought Clay in. Clay went on to do something else, but then Matt and EJ brought in Mark. So Small, that's a little more than you asked, but Small was something once I stayed in Small while the Archers were going because I love Mike and I love his guitar playing and I loved Matt and Chuck. It was a great group of guys to play in a band with.
You guys had a lot of really great songs too. Like, I loved a lot of the songs from that era.
Yeah.
Well, it was a fun band to be in. And I had been a music major at App State in Boone. And I was a saxophone major and I was piano. I played a lot of piano and saxophone. So I didn't play guitar, But I just wanted to write. What I would do instead of practice my saxophone, as I would write songs on a piano at the practice rooms. And finally, I had a smart enough teacher to go, like, man, you don't want to be a band director or a teacher. You need to go somewhere where there's music, you know, where there's bands and stuff. So I moved to Chapel Hill and I bought a guitar. I bought a G&L Super Hawk guitar.
Yep. I remember that thing.
And it was
a song called Super Hawk.
Yeah. So I know. So I bought it. I know what music, you know, I have friends that are guitar players and I know, but my guitar came with the E string broken. And so I was broke as shit, man. I was working at the Carolina coffee shop. Like, I just had no money. So I had this guitar. I think I bought a guy's Yamaha amp, Clay, the guy named Clay, not Clay Boyer, but a different guy named Clay from Asheville. Like, for $100, I bought the guitar and the amp. This is 1988 or 9. Mm-hmm. And didn't have an E string. So I just started writing songs without the E string. When I finally got enough money and I bought a pack of strings, I thought, I don't want the E string there. Because then it makes a third. I don't want a fucking third. I want this. I want a rock. I don't want, you know. And so I took the E string off, put everything down, and put the E on top like a banjo drone. And that's what I have it tuned to now.
That's awesome.
And this is my Archer's guitar. It's right, you know, it's here.
That's there was a interview that I saw with Jesus and Mary Chain where they were talking about how they didn't bother stringing more than 2 strings on the bass. And why we need more than 3 strings on the guitar. And once again, I think it's that like sort of freedom that, you know, yeah, that came with this genre where you didn't have to be doing what the person before you did.
Well, yeah.
And my joke is that my bass has 4 strings, but I only know how to use one of them.
Well, that's all you need.
It works, man.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. You made it work for
I guess your options. Yeah.
Who are the early punk bands from Asheville, Matt? Like, who were some of the early bands?
I didn't know a lot of them, but Urban Spelunkers, they were probably the most successful kind of, you know, like punk band from town. And oddly enough, I feel like when I was in high school, I saw them open for Driving and Crying.
Oh, sure.
And I think I saw them play like a street festival or two in town, but they were cool. Like, they stylistically, they looked a little kind of crusty New York, or like they looked a little bit like Jesus and Mary Chain. They had kind of shaggy hair and wore sunglasses all the time, but they were really fun. And then there was these guys weren't, I don't know if punk really applies, but that band Pure did really well. They're based out of here, and Merge was putting out their records until they had a tragedy. They had a I think it was a van wreck. It might have just been a car wreck, but I forget who was killed in that, but one of the band members was killed, and it obviously ended the band along with it. But they were an excellent band.
There was a band called and this was in my high school. I was south of Asheville, about 11 miles in Skyland, so I was more a little less, not necessarily Asheville, but a little south of there. It's all grown together now, kind of. But and there was a band from my high school, a guy named Sean was in this band, and I love them. And they were called Stations of the Cross.
Oh, wow.
Remember that?
Yes.
Matt? Remember that?
Yeah. I knew there was another that I was trying to remember. Yes. Mm-hmm.
They did pretty well, though. They made a couple of cassettes and they toured quite a bit. They played quite a bit. And I mean, it was very in that 7 second school, it was hardcore, you know. So
they were great.
But they were great. They were great. Yeah.
All my friends in high school were always like writing their little logo, you know, SOTC on their notebooks and stuff.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, they were great.
Yeah, they were cool, man.
I've never heard of them. That's all. Like, but that's the thing is, like, tapes are such a regional format. Like, tapes didn't get out the way records did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And it feels like that is, well, I guess that's also the great thing about punk is that you have so many things that are like Iron Beagle that are documented that wouldn't otherwise be documented because tapes were affordable.
Totally.
Records cost a lot of money. You needed to be a little bit more established to get a vinyl out, but like anyone could get.
And those days were kind of those were the local legend days anyway, because not because anybody was aiming for that. You just didn't have the media to get your stuff out there. You know, you'd put out a little cassette or whatever. Like, you've got, And bands would achieve legendary status within like a 10-mile radius or whatever. Like, Raleigh had a lot of that, you know. Raleigh was like, had all these great bands. Richmond, Virginia had all these great bands, like that band Confessor, that metal band from Raleigh.
Absolutely.
Like,
yep.
Nobody, not that many people have heard of them outside of the Triangle area, but you go inside that area and people, they're legends.
Yeah.
And one of the guys from Confessor went on to play with Penn Rawlings. He played in that band Loincloth. It's kind of a post Breadwinner, Breadwinner style band that, you know, Penn, after Breadwinner broke up, he formed it. And that stuff's amazing. And this guy played from Confessor, plays guitar on it.
Well, even
and like Honor Roll and Honor Roll kind of made it outside of Richmond, but well, everything was pretty insular back then.
Well, that was actually who I was going to bring up, Honor Roll. That's a perfect example of like, even if a band did make it out, to understand what they meant to the local scene versus how they were taken up years later internationally or nationally is so different. And it, I think that's the other thing is like, Honor Roll is a perfect example because I love those records. Like I definitely appreciate them, but everyone who ever saw them tells me you only understand a little.
You don't get it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. They are definitely a band like that. Like the people that actually saw them back in the day, which I never had the chance to, are reverent about them.
Yeah, I've definitely, Mac has driven that home to me many times.
The live experience is so important to what defines them. It's like you could listen to all the Jesus Lizard records in the world, but if you never saw them live, you would miss 80% of what it makes them great. You know?
Totally.
Same idea of Honor Roll, I think.
I had the live record before I got to see them live, and I just remember not really getting the live record. I'm like, why can you barely hear him singing most of the time? Like, what's going on?
What's he doing?
And then you get to see it. You're like, oh, same with Youth of Today. I had a Youth of Today live bootleg before I got to see them live and just, you know, not understanding it as a kid. Like, why is he never singing? Like, who? What's he doing with a microphone at this point?
Yeah.
He's busy, man.
He's using it. Yeah. He's using it. Yeah. He can't be singing it right now. He's using it for something else.
I wanted to ask you about the band Finger, because they're also a band that I love and I feel like not really appreciated as much outside of the local scene.
They were awesome.
That's actually kind of an all-star band. I mean, Brad ended up playing with freaking Keith Urban and stuff. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The guitar player ended up going crazy with like studio musician work and session work and whatever. And he was a phenomenal guitar player back then, and I'm sure he's even more so now.
Yeah, they were all amazing.
John Howie was their drummer, but he ended up being he's a great singer and writer, and John Howie does this country thing now. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's quite good, you know. And I just loved watching that band because I felt like I was watching what the Stones must have been like, you know.
Yeah.
In 1968 or whatever, you know. And Ricky... I don't remember who the bass player was.
I can picture him, but I can't remember his name.
But they were great live. We played.
They were really good.
When I was in band with Kelly Cox, with Mike Kinlan, the early days of Small, we did a few shows with Finger. And I remember I always felt like, oh man, we got to follow these guys, or we got to play before these guys because they were quite handy. They were good. They were like musically, they played well, you know. So.
Yeah, Loaf opened for them in Greenville, I remember.
Yeah.
There's always that band that you dread having to play after. It feels like at every stage of our band, there's been a band where it's like you show up and you're like, oh my God, there's no way we're gonna sound like we're playing on Tinker Toys.
Totally. Well, they were like that. Yeah. Finger was that. Well, their tones were great. They just sounded really good. So.
Well, I think the first Small release is like a three-way split with Motorola and Finger as well, right?
I mean, you might know better than me.
Bishops and Turkey Lips. I'm cheating. I did research, so
yeah,
that's how I know. But I think that's like a vinyl three-way split.
I think that's it is on Matt Records,
on Shakedown Records.
Okay. Well, I don't have it. I wish I had a copy of it. I'm sure it's true.
Well, did you have?
I remember the cover of that album.
What songs? What songs are on that out on that single?
They're Billy Spear versus Jimi Hendrix, Empty Room,
Empty Room,
and Empty then, Room,
Nasty Little Chick.
Okay,
and then Fingers on there too with New and Improved and Out of Focus and
okay, yeah, I know what you're talking about Empty Room and Nasty Little Chick. Nasty Little Chick was kind of Small's hit for the local area. I remember that. That's a Mike Kennel song, and that girl that song was about ended up moving to Seattle. And we saw her in our first tour to Seattle, Matt, we met her or saw her again because she had been a familiar face because she had lived in Chapel Hill, you know, just beautiful purple hair and just beautiful. Oh, she's.
I do. I remember her. Yeah, cool. Well, and Motorola, speaking of supergroups, Motorola, man, they were a supergroup. That guy, John, who played drums, is like such a great drummer. And Mark keeps telling the story where he was talking to John. He was like, man, you are such a good drummer. And John goes, well, you should see me play bass. Apparently he's like, meant it. Like he's
Of course. Yeah. Bass player than the drummer. Irony, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
And he can rip up the guitar. Yeah. Yeah. He's that guy is amazing.
Yeah.
It's wild when you break down, like you're saying, like with all these bands, like in that kind of like geographical area of America, how many kids were coming out of these scenes that would wind up becoming unbelievable musicians, having other careers in music and all that stuff. Like it really is like a light bulb for cool moths to kind of gather around.
Yeah. Yep.
What was your first band, Matt?
My first band was, it was called Rain. We later changed our name to Kangaroo after the Big Star song. But, we were brought together by a kind of a mutual love of the Replacements, and we hung around a lot. And it was, that guy Clay, who was the first like drummer initially for Archers for just the first few months. And a guy named Matt McMichaels, who's, he plays in a bunch of bands now, but, they were, you know, two of my real kind of tightest friend circle. And, they were a drummer and a guitarist, and they were always trying to find a bass player. And one day Matt's like, man, if we're going to be hanging out together all the time and we like all the same music, you might as well learn to play bass. And I was like, yeah, that makes sense. So he taught me how to play little basic bass parts on his acoustic guitar. We'd like come back to his house after like a high school party, and we'd go in his basement. He had gotten a whole bunch of scrap carpet, and he had carpeted every surface to like insulate the basement. And that was the music room.
Yeah.
And we would sit in there, and he would teach me. The first song I learned was Hardly Wait by the Replacements. And, we would sit there and he would teach me how to play. And so then we played in this band together, and we, you know, did a bunch of Replacements and Big Star covers and things like that. But, it was funny, 'cause like years later, like just a few years ago, you know, I've been playing with, Band of Horses lately. And, Ben is a big Replacements fan, and pretty much everybody was, and we were at a sound check, and our guitarist at the time, Ian, just breaks into that opening riff of Hardly Wait, and everybody jumped in, and we played through the song flawlessly first try without knowing that everybody else knew how to play it. And Ben was like, it's going on the set list tonight. And so we started covering it. And so it's kind of funny, like,
that's
how
awesome.
Yeah. Full but anyway, circle,
yeah.
Yeah. Sorry about that digression, but
no.
We played all the way up. I went away to college for a while and then transferred to UNC. And those two guys were already at UNC. So I just kind of got back into the band when I got back. But Eric Johnson knew that I was coming to Chapel Hill. And he had already called me and asked if I wanted to play with him and Eric Bachman. And I knew Eric Bachman, like this high school band that I was in opened for Eric's band back when we were in high school at one point, just one show. And so I knew Eric and knew who he was. We had a lot of common friends, and I'd played music with Eric Johnson before, and I'd played music with Mark Price before and everything. But, anyway, he asked if I wanted to play with them. So I found myself kind of in two bands, like right when Archers started, this other band, Kangaroo, was still kind of going on. And it wasn't until like Archers started getting so busy, I had to kind of, you know, leave Kangaroo, but I've stayed friends with all those guys, and they're good folks.
Did you ever record with that band? Because like a Replacements Big Star influence band from high school sounds awesome.
We have so many 4-track songs, and I think Clay digitized them and put them on a CD somewhere. But I mean, I had just learned. Arguably, I hadn't yet learned how to play bass. It's arguable. I still haven't, but it was really bad then. I was really terrible. I'd just as soon bury it. Like,
I don't know.
Those guys wrote great songs, but man, the bass player, oof.
I think a primitive sounding Big Stars is pretty, you're selling me.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had pretty good tastes. I don't know if it came through in the music or not, but it definitely didn't come through in the bass playing.
It's wild how, you know, like at this point, obviously it's like worlds apart, but like Big Star was such a, like a proto-punk band in a lot of ways. Like, you know, sonically it's not anywhere near doing the same thing as a lot of these bands. But if you look at like the Nerves and right. you look at like a lot of that early New York stuff too, like Blondie, like they're obviously yeah. like an influence on all this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that their approach and their ethic, I guess, I don't mm-hmm. know if that's the right word. Was pretty punk, you know. Mm-hmm. They were doing things for themselves and not really sticking to the canon and all that stuff.
Yeah, the subversion. I mean, just at that time to title a song and to write a song like Holocaust, you know, that's it.
Yeah,
you know? That's
yeah.
not the attitude. You know, you can let that.
And that Big Star's third album yeah. is bonkers.
Yeah,
they did so much weird stuff with that.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
yeah. Like it wasn't until later on that I think after punk, you know, obviously not. Punk itself, because it can be very conservative in its own way, but I mean, like, it kind of opens the door for new wave and all this sort of stuff, where like these bands that were alternative ultimately had space kind of in a more mainstream place. But like Big Star, yeah. it must have been a hard row to hoe back then for them.
I can imagine. Yeah, because mm-hmm. they didn't seem to really care that much. I mean, I'm sure they were kind of bummed they didn't get more success, but they weren't bummed enough to compromise their aesthetic sense, mm-hmm. you know? So I guess, I don't know. I'm not sure, but yeah. And honestly, yeah. Punk too. Punk's gotten pretty conservative.
I think I think it's actually come back around. I feel yeah. like it got its most conservative in the 90s. You know,
yeah.
exactly. Yeah. Like it yeah. now, like you look and go to these shows and it's punk looks like it always talked about itself looking like it is really mm-hmm. diverse now in terms of like the kids yeah. that are on stage and the kids
right.
in the crowd. And yeah, like the sonics they're yeah. making. We went on tour recently and it was like, wow, we're being blown off the stage sometimes by some of these younger bands.
That's awesome. That makes me happy.
That bodes well. Yeah.
And there's almost like two punks now. It's like, there's yeah. definitely a mainstream punk that plays to these huge, like enormous like stadiums and stuff like that, that people that are young that I talk to will throw out names that pack stadiums.
Ooh. Yeah.
And I wouldn't even, I'll never yeah. have heard of them.
Yeah.
And that's a different punk that I'm used to, you know, but I can't be critical of it. I don't know anything about it.
Well, that's why I love doing the show, because I've come to realize that everybody is somebody's poser. And we're all just like, everyone's got their own definition of what this thing is, and for better or for worse. And
yeah.
you're never going to live up to everyone's expectations of it. But that's the thing that makes it amazing, is that we all have our own mm-hmm. connection to it. And it's, yeah. it's something that, like you were saying earlier, like even though we're 14 or 15 hearing this stuff, or even younger, like you were saying that, like we carry it with us for our whole lives.
Yeah.
Like it just mm-hmm. is so fundamentally important.
It leaves a mark.
Yeah. Like it's very interesting to like look at, you know, I've got a number of friends that heard Minor Threat and Straight yeah. Edge, and that was the life they've led ever since. Like, it's almost like religion.
That impact,
I have friends
totally.
Like that too. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's amazing, because they did find something really positive to kind of like, I've got other friends that heard Johnny Thunders and went down a different road. So, you know, I think
right.
Minor Threat's the better one to kind of cling to.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe like, so.
But even those people, change. Like if you know, you talk to Ian McKay now, he's like, you know, you can have a beer. It's cool. He's yeah. not. And they laid back, you know. My wife is friends with from Fugazi, and we were doing some reunion shows. The Archers were doing some reunion shows, and my wife was selling merch just to be with me, you know, during this time. And we were in New York, and he was hanging out with my wife, because they're friends, because through Vic Chestnut, because my wife's uncle is Vic Chestnut. And Guy played in his band. So they're hanging out, and she's watching, he's watching us sell all these shirts. She tells me the story. He's watching us sell all these shirts. He's like, man, these guys sell a lot of shirts. He's like, oh, maybe we should have sold some shirts.
This was us?
They're yeah. He's sitting with Liz at the merch table while we're playing our show at Williamsburg, at the Music Hall of Williamsburg.
I had no
idea. And he just makes a comment that Liz thought was really funny. He's just like, man, we should have sold some shirts.
Did Liz say, well, maybe if your band gets successful one day, yeah, then you can sell some t-shirts. But it was maybe just, if anybody's ever heard of your band, Fugazi. Yeah.
It just speaks to what we're talking about. Like, he's not, these people are not judgmental. These people are not on a high horse, man. They're cool, man. But their band, like Minor Threat or Righteous Springer or whatever, you know, it's got this, it sticks with people, but the band members themselves move on, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's like, you know, and this comes up on the show time and time again, like, we're fixated on these, like, little parts of these people's lives. Like, it's a 2 or 3 year period in some cases, 6 months in some cases. And I know I'm certainly guilty of it, but like almost a fetishization of this like moment in someone's life where they're like, yeah, like I've lived dozens of lives since then.
You're such a sponge at that age. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you're susceptible.
You hold on to it. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
And it's, and as soon as something starts to feel evangelical in any sense, then that you're getting into trouble, I think. and punk definitely has, certainly the hardcore scene kind of struggled with that, you know.
Yeah, I think the I just actually read an incredible book about the unauthorized history of hardline, or an outsider's perspective on the history of hardline. Mm-hmm. And just looking at the most fundamentalist manifestation in punk, which is like the super vegan straight edge kind of movement that sprung up, where people got hurt, like they did carry out actions, and it's wild to look at the rhetoric, and then, you know, you trace it back and it's going back to like British peace punk, and it's going back to like American hardcore stuff, where you're like, I don't think that's what these people envisioned when they wrote these songs.
That's right. Yep.
As soon as you cannot accept a measure of human crapulence and error and fallibility, then you're definitely going off in the wrong direction, I think.
Yeah. I on one level, I definitely applaud anyone that's got enough self-confidence to think they know better than anyone else, because I certainly don't have that at this point in my life.
Me either. I have absolutely zero self-confidence in anything I do.
I obviously have talked to you guys forever, and anytime you guys want to come back on the show and chat more music, you know, the door is always open. But before I go, I wanted what it was like at a certain point with, you know, because obviously Archers of Loaf now a legend beyond reproach, but there's a certain point where there is sort of like a mainstream awareness, it felt like, back in the 90s of the band. And I was just wondering, were you ever, like, did you ever have to deal with the pains of major label pulls or staying indie versus kind of going in a different direction?
Well, I think we had, because of the nature of what was happening at the time, and they were interested in signing us, certain major labels, where we had to deal with it. And obviously we wrote about it a little bit because it was so sort of silly. I think it's fair to say that we did have to deal with it. But I also think it's equally fair to say that we, at the core of the band, didn't really give a shit.
I agree with that.
I mean, we had to, but our answer was a pretty loud no. You know what I mean? We didn't really want to do that. And I think we didn't want to do it, not because we had this sort of moral high ground, but we didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it. I can't speak for anybody else in the band. I didn't want to do that because I felt like if we did that, if we had made that jump, it might have hurt me in the long run, because I knew at that point, I knew in 1994, after the band, the Archers had made like 2 records, I wanted to do this until I was dead. I knew I wanted to create and try to pull money out of it and try to make my life this. If I could do that, I'd be happy enough, you know, happy enough. And I thought, if we have this major label, whichever one it was that was courting us at the time, pay $1 million to Alias to get us off this contract, and we don't make that money back and they drop us, then you're damaged goods. And I'm not going to be able to keep going. So it wasn't. Go ahead.
You can definitely speak for me on that. I'm in full agreement.
It turned out to be the right decision, because I'm 52 now. Yeah. I was 24 at the time, and I've still been able to pull it off. If we had done that, I think I'd have been sort of like this cheesy prick that tried something that didn't work and I made a fool of myself and didn't do that. So,
yeah.
So it wasn't an issue of like, I mean, in my heart of hearts, I do feel this way. Like it wasn't fuck corporate rock, although I, you know, fuck corporate rock, you know, but whatever. but it's not that. It's if I could have made $1 trillion doing it, I'll dance with the devil. Fuck it. I don't care, you know.
Yeah.
But it wasn't going to happen. And that's the core problem of it. They're exploiting people. They're fucking people over. That's what's repulsive. Not that some friends could do a band to make money. I want my friends' bands to make money. I want them to do well, you know. So that's an old story. We've heard it a million times, but that's why we didn't do it, you know.
Yeah, for me, it didn't. That was the same. It didn't work out in the long run in my mind. I was like, this is a losing proposition if we do this. But at the time, I don't remember. It didn't feel painful. It felt awkward very many times. But basically, these people are taking you to lunch. And then you do like sort of a cursory walk through the office and like kind of get introduced to a bunch of people and they're all nice, you know, and then you go to the little vault at the end of the tour and they've got all their releases like stacked up in this vault and they let you just fill up a bag if you want. So I got a whole bunch of CDs that I wanted as a kid and got a free lunch. And, and I remember I don't want to like get anybody in trouble. So there's one label that I guess technically wasn't a major label, but was very well financed by a very high profile person who wanted us to sign on that label. And they kept sending a rep from the label who was a delightful human being, would just take us out to dinner all the time. We said, look, you need to know in advance, we have absolutely no intention of signing to this label and we don't want to make it difficult for you. And the person was like, okay, cool. As long as I keep getting sent to take you guys out to dinner, I'm going to keep taking you guys out to dinner and we'll have a great time. Yeah. And we did. Every time that person would show up, we'd go out. They'd take us out to dinner and we'd have a blast.
I mean, Damien,
full understanding that we are never going to sign.
You have to understand these people that are courting you are also just people that work for the thing. And they're not working there. They're not working there anymore. Mm-hmm. They probably didn't work there a year later. Mm-hmm. So it's just a bunch of kids like, being handed money to go out to dinner and they're trying to talk about business and we're just like
that's a good description.
I mean it's just like everybody's just playing this fucking game.
And
I guess, you know, if you're really ambitious and you really want to do that, you know, fine, you know, but I just didn't feel like it was gonna work. I just didn't see that. I didn't see the end game, you know.
No, all I saw was like an immediate like loan. And then a whole bunch of debt
is what it felt like to me.
That was sort of what it felt like. Like it felt like an indenture trap or something. And so it didn't really appeal to me. I wasn't real happy with, I mean, I won't lie. I wasn't real happy with the relationship we had with our current label at the time. I had issues with it and was a little bitter about it or whatever, but it was still preferable to going down that other road, you know.
And I think to be fair, if we had been wiser earlier on and had not done that particular deal, we might have done a different thing.
Absolutely.
We might have done this with because we like this guy. We like Jim Barber from Geffen. We would have liked that guy. I like that guy. That would have worked, or whatever it would have been. Mm-hmm. We might have done that. And that we'd be having a completely different conversation now, you know.
Yeah.
But given where we were in that moment, I feel very good about where it landed. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah. I think that's the thing with these major label things. It's like you're looking at it and it's just, you know, it's like buying a lottery ticket. The hope is that you become the Clash, and the reality is you might become, well, at best, like a Chumbawamba who had a huge hit, you know. Mm-hmm. but then it like kind of undercut, like, I think a lot of their amazing other stuff they did before that, where I don't think they're looked at in the same way that they would have been.
Right.
But
exactly.
Yeah, you know. But it's a gamble. And then there's tons of bands that we just, you know, like too numerous to mention that we never heard of again after they signed.
Yeah. And it just sucks it dry out.
Yeah. Like it really does feel like when you're in control of your own career, for better or for worse, like at least it's yours, man.
You know, at least you can say, okay, I'm still going, I'm still climbing up, you know, I'm still doing whatever.
Yeah. You don't want to get trapped. You need to be able to stay mobile, in my opinion. And I think that those big companies tend to, it's just the way the model's set up. You can get trapped in that stuff pretty easily.
Mm-hmm. It's a weird time now too, because it's so different. I mean, again, these are people making these things up. So if you want to talk about what are we defining? What are we talking about? A major label? Are we talking about Andy at Anti? Those people are killer. You know, right. Who are we talking about? Yeah. It's Merge is a change. Massive label. It's like Merge is a big label. It's a big fucking label now. Are these people unreasonable? No, they're not. So who are we talking about? You know, back then it was more cut and dry. Back in 1991.
The dynamics of the 90s were completely different than they are now.
Yeah. It was a different economy, right? Like the idea is like you could buy a CD from a DIY label and they're... It's not like, you know, it's an independent distribution company at that point, and it's all analog. But now we're ultimately all digital. We're all going to be streaming service. The little DIY label that put out one of our first 7-inches is up there right beside the multinational indie label, quote unquote indie label that we were on for a few records too. You know, it's
And 15... I have no problem with that. Yeah. I kind of love that. It's a little more. It's a little less, like Eric said, cut and dried now than it was then. But I kind of like that, you know. It's a little more floating and less mapped out, I suppose. Or maybe it is, and I'm just not aware of it.
Well, and I think that the amazing thing is that this scene does thrive. And like you were saying, there's this massive stadium manifestation of what punk is. But then there's also like these tiny 20 people shows in the basement where the next wave of artists are going to come out of that. I think is
the whole house show thing.
Exactly.
And
it's like, there's going to always be sort of a natural life cycle where you kind of like, you don't age out of the mentality or the ideals, but you age out of being part of this little pure capital P punk scene because you get into different stuff and you can't stay, you know, can't be Peter Pan forever.
You got to grow.
Totally.
Yeah, that's right.
And I honestly couldn't give a rat's ass as long as people are getting that itch scratched, you know, as long as you're getting that kind of emotional payback from whatever music you're listening to, whatever music you found, you know, that's the important thing. As long as it's getting out there and people are digging it. Yeah. I don't care. I don't care how big a band is or small a band is. As long as people are getting what they want out of the music, you know.
Yeah. A lot of my favorite bands didn't make more than 200 records. It's like, who am I to say what's good music and what's bad music?
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely.
Well, I will tell you one thing. This has been good times. And anytime either of you or both of you want to come back on this show and talk about circle jerking or DIYing, you're always welcome.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Damien. It's
been
a blast.
Thank you so much. Yeah. This has been wonderful.
Thank you, Matt and Eric, for coming on the show. And hopefully they will be back for another conversation because I had a great time doing that chat. Also, shout out to my buddy, Zach Felberg. Zach was another guy who has long been championing Arches of Loaf to me in the early days and, you know, got Play Me Crooked Fingers for the first time. So shout out to Zach and shout out to Tristan. And shout out to Arches of Loaf. Pick up that new record. Reason in Decline, coming out on Emerge, October 21st. Fantastic. Great band. Unbelievable band. That's why we do this. Have fun chats with people we like. That's what we're doing here. Speaking of that, coming up on the next episode of Turned Out of Punk, a very good friend of mine coming back for a part two, Autry Fulbright from the band Off, formerly from At You, and You Will Know Us by the Trail of the Dead, and also of the band Dead Havens. A great guy. I'll have a fun little chat, a catch up. We haven't had a catch up on this podcast in years. It's been a long time since it's been on the show. So I'm looking forward for you to hear that. All right. That is it for me this week. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues of Indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and stop hate and violence towards people of different faiths and different races. Because this is not politics. This is just basic human rights shit. People deserve to live free from hate and violence and fear. So get involved in organizations that are doing positive and good work in this world. Lend your time, lend your support, lend your money if the call is out there for that. I also add to this, we support people's rights to have abortions. And this is a human right. This isn't a political issue. There's lots of stuff that's politics. We can talk about politics all day, you know, lines on the road or I don't know. A lot of stuff spills over, of course. Like I was going to say school, but school is also kind of a human right too, or it should be a human right. Anyway, we're getting distracted from the issue here. So get involved in organizations that are doing positive work in this world and fuck all that Nazi fascist bullshit. There's no place for it. Sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them. You really don't. You're going to be dead. So they will take those organs and give someone a new lease on life. I've seen it happen. I've seen it with my own eyes. Well, not actually the surgery, but I've seen the effects of it. So please try meditating. Please try meditating, because I didn't really believe in it. And every time I do it, I feel so much better. And it takes a while to kind of get adjusted to it. But then you just notice things from the meditation practice kind of seeping into your life. And it just, I don't know, I really do feel like it is a really great self-improvement practice. And this is coming from someone who had no interest in it as of a couple years ago. You listen to old episodes of this podcast, I don't talk about meditation at all. But now it's kind of working for me. Maybe it'll work for you. Also, make your own culture, because anyone can do this shit. Start a band, start a fanzine, start something. Start producing something creative, because that'll also help your mental health. And that's it. Thank you very much for supporting this thing, and thank you very much for listening. I'll see you on the next episode. Bye!